welcome to another segment of the Grassy Knoll on this February 21st. That's when we were recording this, 2005. And with us today is Craig Heimbichner, author of Blood on the Altar, The Secret History of the World's Most Dangerous Secret Society. And welcome to the Grassy Knoll, Craig.
Thank you, Keith.
If I were to say to people, or I would pose this question to people, who is the world's most dangerous secret society, you might get a couple of answers.
That's true.
But what's your answer? Who are they, and why are they the most dangerous?
Well, my answer is pretty clear. If you read the book, it's the Ordo Templi Orientis, which means Order of Oriental Templars, and it's usually just abbreviated as the OTO. Most people have never heard of them. And a few books have had references to the OTO over the years, but nobody's ever actually done a book-length expose and put in research on their actual documents within their order to expose them. But what they are, in essence, is a Masonic academy. That's how they styled themselves when they got going about 100 years ago, an Academia Masonica, sort of a graduate school for Freemasons. And the reason they're the most dangerous secret society is partly because of their behind-the-scenes role, which is obviously pretty successful since most people haven't heard of them, even though they're in 40 countries today, and also because of the fact that they have had their hands in just about every cookie jar you could imagine, from government to Hollywood to pop culture, education, the space program, and so forth. And they've been very, very successful.
What drew your attention to this particular group? Mainly, I said it because I remember a couple of years ago we kind of did a thumbnail on all the occult societies, or as many as we could find, and I did come across the OTO, and I looked over their website, and of course there's Astro Argentum and all that. So how did you focus on the OTO?
I focused on the OTO because as I studied Freemasonry, increasingly all the roads started pointing there in terms of advanced Freemasonry. And now I have to qualify that today you can go into the OTO. They've dropped the old requirement that you had to first be a Master Mason and so forth, which was the original requirement. But they've dropped that for an important reason, and that's because the average teenager and above is already initiated into the realm of the occult through pop culture so effectively that they can skip what used to be basic training and get it rapidly in the OTO itself. But it was still considered advanced level Freemasonry. So since all the fingers pointed in that direction from the documents, and I try to work from Masonic source documents and statements of their leaders, and I did, I would say, intelligence work, but I won't go into details. Obviously, that would compromise sources and so forth. But everything started to point to the OTO, so that's where I turned.
Is it correct to assume that OTO is actually beyond Freemasonry?
Yes, that's very correct to assume that. Although I know I've had some OTO people say, well, that's not correct anymore. That's what it used to be. But now you have the phenomenon where some people start with the OTO and then go and involve themselves in the regular stuffy version of Freemasonry, which is available in your town in the Blue Lodge or the Scottish Rite. But it still is the step beyond Freemasonry in that most people who join the Masonic Lodge join it for the propaganda reasons that are out there. That's benevolent order and help society and all of that window dressing that is used to recruit people. And also for family reasons, or families are involved, or finally one of the most important reasons, they want to grease their career track because it's a favoritism system and a protectionist system, which advances people who are involved in their various careers. But if they get involved with that, they only go so far typically. And most people, although they are organs of some of the agendas of Masonry, consciously or unconsciously, just through their involvement and then their involvement back in society, they don't get into the occult, although all Freemasonic writings at the highest levels point the finger there. So where do you get into the occult? Well, that's where you have to go the step beyond, and you have to go to a group like the OTO, which is the signature group of occult masonry.
We have heard from time to time, or read from time to time, that with Freemasonry, it can go and does go beyond 33 degrees. One, yes. Did you encounter anything to that regard in your work? And two, is it true? Is it false? Do the degrees take over in the OTO?
Well, that's a very good question. And the answer, first of all, is yes, there's plenty beyond the 33rd degree. The obvious immediate answer to that would be the Memphis and Mizraim rites, which go respectively to Memphis to 97th degree and Mizraim to 90th degree. And one of the most important leaders of the OTO, who I'm sure we'll be talking about, Aleister Crowley, he was at 97th and 90th degree in both rites. So you have the Scottish rite up to 33. Memphis and Mizraim go much further. But what the OTO does is it tops out at an 11th degree, which some will say, well, how can you have something higher than 97, which is 11? Well, it's because what the OTO then does is distill down and condense the most powerful points of occult initiation into just a few degrees. So by the time you're at, say, the 7th degree in the OTO, you're already at, you're already past the 33rd degree in the equivalent Scottish Rite. And they move you rapidly through the levels of the occult and take you to, the highest degree would be the 11th. And then there's a related order that they have, the Astrum Argentium, the Order of the Silver Star. And that order actually plunges a person, if they want to go into it, into even deeper levels of occult initiation. What I would say a good description of what they're getting you to is what C.S. Lewis called the miserific vision, mm-hmm. sort of the opposite of the vision of God. mm-hmm. But anyway, they really work you past that at a more individual level in the Argentium Astrum, which is the AA, not related to Alcoholics Anonymous directly, but has the same letters.
All right, so in a ranking order, then, AA goes even beyond the OTO.
It actually does, and there aren't too many people you will find involved with the AA. Even in the OTO, it's not everybody who goes into that.
Just as a little aside, whenever I listen to, you're familiar with Coast to Coast, right?
Oh, yes.
With Art Bell and all that? Well, whenever I would have insomnia or be working a late shift and I would listen to it, once upon a time what I heard was, I guess it's a British Mason who wrote a book and completely denied that there was anything beyond the third element, the third degree, a complete
right.
reversal of the truth.
Right.
One other night I heard two guys that were calling in, I guess, to the show, or maybe it was the one guest, whatever, but the one popped off something in Latin, the other responded in Latin. And the host at the time, whose name I forget, but he's gone now, out of Atlanta, he goes, whoa, what happened there? And that's when I first heard them say, do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law.
Yes, that's the OTO standard greeting. And if you ever were in a coffee shop, and I don't think too many people will encounter this, but if they're in a coffee shop near an OTO lodge, they might hear a couple of people exchange a bizarre greeting. Hey, how you doing? Do what thou wilt. And the other will say, love is the law. Or they might say the full version, do what thou wilt, shall be the whole of the law. And the other will say, love is the law, love under will. That's their coded greeting to each other. It comes out of a document of theirs called the Book of the Law, which we can talk about in a bit. But it's important to note that when they are speaking of love, they have something in mind entirely distant and unrelated to the average person's understanding of love. In fact, the OTO in the final analysis is a system of tyrannical control. Even though they bill themselves as very libertarian and loosey-goosey and that sort of thing.
Well, you're going to find this rich, I think, anyway. I work for a Catholic university library.
Oh.
And in that library, in our reference, I think unbeknownst to the director, is Mackey's two-volume work, the Encyclopedia of Freemasonry. You see, you know where that's going, right?
Right.
And this is just a digression. I'm not going to go down this route. But, I mean, don't you think that the objections of Catholicism toward Freemasonry and vice versa is pretty much play-acting?
I'll answer that in two parts. I'd say historically at a certain point in the beginning conflict between Masonry and Catholicism, there was very legitimate objections from 1738, Clement the 12th denounced it and so forth. This was all very real at that point. There was some pretty serious opposition. But right now, there's been a measure of convergence achieved between the ecclesiastical institution associated with the OTO. They have their own Catholic Church. Very few people know about it, but it's called the Gnostic Catholic Church, mm-hmm. the Ecclesia Gnostica Catholicum, EGC, that's right. And the EGC, or the Gnostic Catholic Church, holds a Gnostic Mass at their lodges every Sunday night at what they call nightfall, which is sort of a shifting hour of the night, but based on the day, time of the year and the seasons and all that sort of thing. But it's when it's dark, obviously, and that's appropriate time for them to do it. But this Gnostic Mass or Gnostic Catholic Church and so forth historically had some opposition in the late 19th century between the Roman Catholic Church. But as I show in my book, there's a chapter there where there was a cardinal who was Secretary of State to Leo XIII and was in line to become Pope after the death of Leo XIII. He almost made it. And there was some behind-the-scenes invoking of an ancient law by a French Monsignor who was sort of a Sherlock Holmes, very sincere man, tried to track down Masonic intrigue. And he found out that this cardinal, Rompola, was somehow some sort of a Mason. He didn't know about the OTO, probably. But he had certainly had some reasons to strongly suspect this man. And they vetoed, through an ancient law, the election of Rompola, and then they got Pius X, who ironically turned out to be a very sincere opponent of Freemasonry, and went after about every version of it he could find. But he didn't get them all. And by the end of the 20th century, the ascendancy of Masonry within the Catholic Church and the changes affected are sources of numerous studies. I relate them in a sort of encapsulized version at, let's say, I think it's chapter 8 or 9 or something in my book called Catholicism and the Crosshairs. But I'll just mention one, and that is just that the thelemic essence of the OTO, they use the word thelema, which means will from the Greek, do what thou wilt. This whole notion is rife within modern Catholicism. I mean, it's sort of... doesn't matter what you do, you know, God, sort of this grandfather who loves you, that fits in very hand and glove, or hoof and glove, or whatever you want to say, right. With the notions of the OTO, which is sort of this loosening up. And the reason they want to loosen up culture, a sort of freewheeling, do your own thing message, is not because they really believe in that. If you study the writings of the OTO's leaders, they really want, in their final vision, a tyrannical world rule in which they say that the slaves shall serve. That's a line from one of their documents. In fact, it's the title of one of their books of one of their most important leaders recently. They want to loosen everything up with the left wing so that they can counter-strike from the right and bring about a sort of police state or tyrannical world rule. And they've been using the Catholic Church where they can. Mm-hmm. They've been using education, the media, politics, and so forth, wherever they can.
Before we get into the nuts and bolts of the OTO and the personalities that are on the floor there,
yeah.
So you believe, too, that the left and right we see, the Democrats and the Republicans, for more than one reason, is pretty much a game. It's just the same goal with a different approach.
Oh, it definitely is. It definitely is. The left and the right, actually, I refer to this in my book, and I also have a CD on this, a talk called The Double Mind and Occult Philosophy, which is available from the publisher of my book, Independent History and Research. I have a whole lecture on that and trace that back to the Kabbalah itself, which is organized in three pillars, the Kabbalah of Rabbi Luria. When the people say, well, what's the Kabbalah? I'm probably going a little bit fast here. But the Kabbalah mm-hmm. is the black magic side of Judaism, and it's the mysticism and the occultism of that religion. But the Kabbalah is organized in a schema which has a right and a left. Two pillars. One's called the pillar of severity, the other is the pillar of mercy. So the pillar of severity equates to the right, the pillar of mercy to the left, and the masters of the Kabbalah, the initiated, would stand in the middle with the pillar of equilibrium, or sometimes mm-hmm. called the pillar of mildness. And what they do is they look at the vantage point from there, they can control the game. So back when this was minted into the French National Assembly through Freemasons in 1798, this whole right-left arrangement, from there on out, we've had politics divided into a right and a left, and it's a ping-pong game where the masters of the game sit in the middle and control the show.
At this point, too, let's do some business. Folks, you're listening to the Grassy Knoll on Dade City Micro Radio. This is Viz. With me is Craig Heimbichner, author of the book we're talking about today, Blood on the Altar, The Secret History of the World's Most Dangerous Secret Society. You mentioned another title or two. Would you please give us them and where people can go to get their hands on those books?
Oh, thank you very much. Well, my book, Blood on the Altar, you can order it direct from the publisher, or you can get it from Amazon.com also. That's the easiest way for people to probably get a hold of it. They could log on there and enter part of the title, like Blood on the Altar, The Secret History. That'll pull it up. Or if they want to go direct the publisher, the advantage there is they can also get a hold of a CD of my talk or a taped version of it, The Double Mind and Occult Philosophy. And if they log on to the publisher, Independent History and Research, at www.revisionisthistory.org, they can find both right there. And that's all one word, revisionist history. And I'd be very delighted to find that people are interested in either one or both.
You know, people who are mildly aware of secret societies might understand that there is high-degree Freemasonry.
Yes.
None of them have a clue, for the most part. There's an OTO.
Right.
Now, has Masonry gotten a greater exposure to throw anybody off the trail, or are you trying to, and if that is so, are you trying to make people aware there's something beyond it and you shouldn't let them off the hook as well?
Yes. I'd say that Freemasonry receives a lot of attention for a couple of reasons. One is it has more of a conservative standard face, which fits with the average member of society's career and lifestyle and that sort of thing. I mean, it's easier to explain to somebody, I'm in the Masonic Lodge. Oh, what's that? Well, that's that group down the street that's kind of like the Rotary, they'll say, or something like that. You know, it fits in. It's standard. It's more normal. At least that's what they tell you. And so if I went around saying I'm a member of the OTO and it's an occult order, some people might get their hackles up. So it's easier for a person to say they're a member of the, and I, of course, I'm a member of neither one. I don't want anybody to think that. But that's one reason why one has received more attention. It has more of a conservative face. And the other reason is, I think exactly what you're on to, is that certain orders in history work more effectively behind the scenes, and they don't, it's when they are actually getting a measure of exposure, something is going on, which is a very interesting thing called revelation of the method. Michael Hoffman II, researcher and colleague of mine, went into great detail on this in one of his books, which you can also get at on that website, revisionisthistory.org, called Secret Societies and Psychological Warfare, which I would not hesitate to recommend.
Okay.
And in that book, he talks about how at this stage in the alchemical game of processing the group mind of the populace and the level of hypnosis and trance state of the general public is deemed ready for more revelations of what's really going on. So the OTO is watching my book very carefully right now, and they're hoping and betting at their highest levels that the game works in their favor. And we, of course, are hoping and working toward the game working against them. But that's sort of the mutual risk involved in releasing information like this. They hope, in other words, let me clarify that a little bit.
Sure.
When there's an exposure of a group like that, they're hoping that what happens is that the average person who reads it simply is fascinated with it, puts it away, and then goes back to Blockbuster Video, ESPN Sports, and just goes back into hypnosis and does nothing. And if that happens, the trance state has actually been deepened for that person. So they're hoping that that's what happens. But on the other hand, we're hoping that it helps bring them out of the trance. So there's always risk involved when you release information like this.
Pike stated in Morals and Dogma that every occult society sprang from the Kabbalah.
That's right.
Now, with the OTO, does it also, even though Crowley is credited with starting it, I guess, is its roots go back to Theosophy? Is there any connection with Madame B?
Yeah, there is a connection with Madame B or Madame Blavatsky. If you want to connect with them, you have to look at some of the early founders of the OTO who are also members of Theosophy. Madame Blavatsky was one of the pioneers of occultism and initiated many people into that. She was definitely connected with Albert Pike as well. But actually, to get to the essence of where the OTO originated, you have to move back through what Blavatsky was doing and look at some Kabbalistic origins. And here's where, you know, I don't want to boast about my research or something, but I think the chapter on the Judaic connection is material that's simply unavailable, pulled together in one source anywhere else. So I think readers might be interested in that, because I show, and I document it, that the initiation of the early leaders of the OTO, specifically Theodore Royce, Kellner, and some of these others who were involved with its startup and the startup of movements right before it, they were actually connected with a man who came out of Poland. He was a Grand Master of the Egyptian Hermetic Brotherhood of Light in the 1870s. He went by the code name, and they all have code names, Max Theon, which means Supreme God. Oh, these guys love puffed-up titles,
uh-huh.
too.
Uh-huh.
But his real name was Louis Maximilian Bimstein. He was son of a rabbi in Warsaw, Poland, and he had a Hasidic initiation into Judaism before he left Poland. And the OTO itself has admitted that there were connections to Frankist Kabbalists and so forth in the startup and forerunners of their organization. But this is very little known. Anyone who reads on the OTO will be misdirected and told, oh, its actual source is from the Sufis of Islam. Well, this is another level of the con game going on right now, where we're being misdirected in a magic show to look at the hand that's moving, that is Islam. Well, the hand that's not moving and is behind the scenes, that is the Zionists and Judaics, connected with the Freemasons, are really working the populace. But the Kabbalistic roots go far, far back. Once you get there, you can trace the lineage way back. And so really what this is all about the Kabbalah, just like Pike said. It all goes back there. And I quote in the start of that chapter, for those who are skeptical and would accuse me of certain biases and so forth, I quote from the Royal Arch Degree of Freemasonry, for the good of Masonry generally, but the Jewish nation in particular. That's an actual quote from the ritual mm-hmm. of the Royal Arch of Freemasonry, which is considered the completion of the Master Mason degree. So it's explicit in their own rights that they have an agenda and a connection there.
Would these Jews that are in the OTO, would they necessarily be Talmudic Jews?
Well, yes, in the sense that at the essence of the Talmud is a mindset, the real Talmud, not mm-hmm. the one that's sometimes mistranslated. But if you want to get the real Talmud, you have to get something like Rabbi Adin Steinsaltz's version, which he produced about 20 volumes of that, and production was somehow halted for some strange reason. But he was actually putting back into it the translations of key passages where the name of Jesus Christ is blasphemed. It's said in there that he's boiling in hot excrement in hell and so forth, and that the best of the Gentiles should be killed. These statements you can find in Rabbi Steinsaltz's Talmud, and he's considered the highest Talmudic scholar in the world. He was recipient of the highest honor in Israel, the Israeli Prize, among numerous other honors. But the Talmudic Jewry would be, or Judaism, I should say, rather, mm-hmm. is both conveyed by those who would be involved with it at the Orthodox level, but I think at a much more subtle level. Somebody doesn't have to be involved with it explicitly in ceremony to imbibe the essence of its mindset. And in that sense, you have a Talmudic mindset behind involvement in the OTO, even where there's no explicit connection with Orthodox practice.
See, the reason I ask that, because it can become a bit of a complex situation. Mm-hmm. Do you think the predominance of Masonry, and what about OTO, is Jewish?
Well, mentally, yes.
Okay.
And I'll qualify that. And I'll say I don't look at Judaism in terms so much as a racial issue. Actually, racially and genetically, you have a lot of confusion there. You have
right.
the Khazars and so forth mm-hmm. Converting in about the 8th century. They're Eastern Europeans, and the descendants of them are Ashkenazic Jews. Mm-hmm. And they primarily make up what's over in Israel today, claiming to be Semitic, and they're not. I mean, it's a real, real irony that in the name of anti-Semitism, persons accused, rather, of anti-Semitism, if they defend the rights of a Palestinian, let's say a Palestinian Christian Arab whose home just got bulldozed and is truly Semitic, from the tank that was driven by a descendant of an Eastern European who converted in the 8th century,
yeah.
And if you oppose that tank, you're called an anti-Semite. So you have all these weird racial cross connection and so forth, but the mentality of Judaism, you have to go right back to the Gospels and you can see it. I don't know how a person can read it and miss it. But the mentality is clear in all of the opposition of the synagogue to Jesus Christ. And ultimately, of course, the agitation for his crucifixion comes directly from the Sanhedrin and the leaders of Judaism.
It's something.
Freudian slip there.
You got it. You got it.
but anyway, the mentality is definitely there, and it's what's called in Freemasonry. They have members, and then they have what they call a Mason without an apron, and that is somebody who, while not being a conscious member necessarily, spreads their agenda. Well, there's a parallel to that in terms of Judaism. It's pretty much what the old useful idiot expression of Lenin, mm-hmm. that somebody can do the work for them, a dupe. And there can be a mixture of conscious and unconscious cooperation in this, but the key thing is if the work gets done. So in that sense, the whole Judaic mentality is at the bottom of the OTO. And increasingly, as a person gets into deeper levels of the OTO, that becomes very apparent. In fact, Crowley's really, who is an important leader of the OTO, writes about it. He says the basis of their work is the Holy Kabbalah. He's that clear about it.
Did you want to finish off something?
No, that's okay.
Okay. The reason why I wanted you juxtaposed in time to some of our other guests is mm-hmm. because at the root of all this, what we're dealing with in one way or another, and I got to tell you, as I was reading the book, I started thinking about, boy, this sounds an awful lot like Aldous Huxley. I wonder if he was in the OTO. And sure enough, you know, just as soon as I
right.
asked the question, I came upon it.
Right.
But we have two brothers, Philip and Paul, who mm-hmm. have written books about the scientific dictatorship, which is Luciferian in its roots.
Yes.
And they hit on Crowley.
Right.
And then we had Chris Pinto, who's a documentary filmmaker of the Megiddo series, mm-hmm. and he had a lot on Crowley.
Good.
And so let's now center on this character who, you know, I think a lot of people think is fun and games and just spooky stuff, but this guy was not fooling around, was he?
Not fooling around at all. He put out a certain dramatic personae, which is still with many people. A lot of the young people resonate with that aspect of Aleister Crowley. You know, you have the pop culture of Ozzy Osbourne,
yep.
Mr. Crowley, that
yep.
song. His name's frequently called Crowley, but he actually pronounced it himself Crowley, which is fine. It's Creepy Crowley, I guess.
Either way.
Something like that. But anyway, Crowley himself was a British agent. Let's get right to the bottom of it. The man worked for British Secret Service, along with figures like his friend Ian Fleming, who
yep.
is the
author
man,
of James
of course,
Bond.
He wrote the James
right.
Bond series 007, which is another thing we could get into.
Hmm.
But I'll just briefly mention that 007 was the code name for John Dee, the court occultist of Elizabeth I. And I have some material on him. Michael Hoffman has a lot of material on John Dee and his role in the birth of Freemasonry. But all of these things, you point back, you get to the British connection. And why is that important? British agencies, British intelligence. Because a lot of people don't realize how interconnected these con games and these Masonic con games and images are to the government. And when you penetrate back far enough, you find connections to the government. You find it today with the OTO, with figures like Jack Parsons shipping military secrets to the Israelis, having top flight intelligence clearance. And he was a disciple of Aleister Crowley, who ran an important lodge in the United States, the most important lodge in the United States at the time. We can talk about him later. But Crowley was basically a Mason's Mason. And it's funny because if you get on the regular Grand Lodge websites, some of them will say, well, Crowley never had official recognition from any Grand Lodge. They love to play these games with the goyim, with the outsiders, with the Cowans, as they call them. And they like to have these official denials, et cetera, of any connection with this lodge or that lodge, just like that person you mentioned who denied there was anything past a third degree or 33rd degree.
Right.
They love to issue all of these pretentious denials. But if you go into those lodges, you'll find the guys who are issuing those denials, many cases at the occult lodge the next night themselves.
You know? Right.
It's
right.
a game.
Uh-huh.
And Crowley was not only a 33rd degree Scottish Rite, 97th degree Rite of Memphis, 90th degree Rite of Mizraim, and then, of course, became he rose rapidly in the ranks of the OTO and became one of their most important leaders. And it's funny because even today, the same con games are debated at certain levels in the OTO with lower members about who is really the successor of Theodore Royce. And while they're debating all of this, of course, the control groups are steamrolling their agenda forward. They even play games against their lower members, and Pike mentions that, and I quote him in his book on how they exactly confess to deception within their lodges against their lower members. Crowley became famous as sort of the grandfather of Satanism. I won't call him a father of Satanism. I think Anton LaVey probably gets that title of modern Satanism. But as sort of grandfather, an inspiration to Anton LaVey and many others, you'd have to put Aleister Crowley. I mean, he's the central man of the age. And he also put out a whole literary outpouring of works of poetry. Some of it's extremely poor, but some of it was not bad in the sense that it got some favorable reviews early on until he started writing things like Hymn to Lucifer and that sort of thing. That general public didn't go for that. But he wrote fiction, he wrote nonfiction, he wrote detective stories, and he started up lodges. He started up a commune in Italy, and finally Mussolini threw him out, which is kind of amusing. But Mussolini kicked him out from his Abbey of Thelema, which was patterned after Rabelais' construct in Rabelais' work, same concept, sort of a freewheeling prototype of the hippie commune of the 60s. And he was a drug addict, serial sodomizer, pederast, bisexual, the whole thing. So when you came to the 60s, of course, and that whole thing was started up again with government shadows in the background, you have a reinvocation of Crowley, and you had that on the Beatles album, Sgt. Pepper's right. Lonely Hearts Club Band, where they had People We Like, and they have a lot of people staring out of the background as a large mass group photo sort of montage, actually, mm-hmm. or collage. And you have Crowley, skinhead. And by the way, he's the source of the whole skinhead look. People mm-hmm. trace that back to, they don't know where it goes, but a lot of people have traced it back to Anton LaVey, father of Church of Satan, but he actually patterned himself after Aleister Crowley, so it's kind of ironic, you know, the whole craze of the shaved heads, and many of them you'll find in sort of Christian rock bands and that sort of thing, people shaving their heads and whatnot, and it's all after Aleister Crowley's original look, but they don't know that frequently. Anyway, Crowley is a hero to sort of the pop culture, but behind the scenes he was a Mason's Mason, an aristocrat, very wealthy, very well connected with British high society, and an agent of the British government. And that's a sort of prototype or example of exactly the con game being played today by the OTO and other related cognate groups. They like to retail a version of themselves which attracts a certain segment of society, the youth or whatnot, or the rebel, or if it's a standard lodge, they go for the more conservative-minded person, the patriot. And if you penetrate behind it, you get to the government. You get to control. You get to tyranny. You get to long-range control projects. And that could bring us to a description, if you want to go there, of the whole thelemic mechanism, as we call it, on how they manage a sort of ping-pong between the left and the right.
Let's do that, but before you do, once again, you're listening sure. to The Grassy Knoll on Dade City Micro Radio. With us is Craig Heimbichner, the author of Blood on the Altar, The Secret History of the World's Most Dangerous Secret Society. That refers to what we're talking about today, the OTO, the Ordo Templi Orientis. That book can be bought at Amazon.com and on Michael Hoffman's website, which is, again,
it's www.revisionisthistory.org.
And you have another title for sale?
The Double Mind in Occult Philosophy. It's a CD of a talk about 50 okay. minutes long, which goes deeper into the Kabbalistic control groups or mechanism behind these groups.
All right. If you don't mind, let's pick up where we left off.
Sure. I was talking about the ping-pong game and how that's played out. And a lot of people don't understand that there's a connection between the left and the right. They frequently divide themselves up and waste a lot of energy on one side or the other of the equation. And so you open up the typical letters to the editor section of a newspaper and you have angry people from the left wing writing to object to the right and angry people from the right wing writing in to object to the left. Neither has any clue that groups who are managing the alchemical processing of the group mind are connected and are connecting the two. And the way they do that is this. They like to loosen up culture at periods in history. You'll see this happen time and again. Things get loosened up by the left wing, the pillar of mercy of the Kabbalah, as it's called, and there will be connections back to government agents. Look at the drug culture and where that came from, and you trace it back and you find government laboratories. So you go back far enough, and you'll see the shadows of the government, but the populace doesn't know that. They think they're engaged in some sort of left-wing rebellion against authority. But of course, if that goes too far, then the stage is set for a corresponding crackdown.
Right.
And then the right wing comes in with its control. The pillar of severity kicks in. And you see that played out. If you look at the writings and the documents of the OTO, it's almost a case study of that phenomenon. The lower members are told this is all about liberty, freedom, thalima, do your own thing, do what thou wilt, or whatever you want to call it. But if you get to the writings of the top leaders, they're saying things like, at the end, we're going to take the sword to the slaves of the slave gods. And that's their word if you read the writings for Christians. They call them slaves of the slave gods. They say, we'll take the sword to them when the hour is right. We'll strike. And they say, the slaves shall serve. So, in fact, they said that the average person needs to enjoy the quiet wisdom of the cattle. That's in another writing from Aleister Crowley, who was probably their most important leader. So you have these overt statements at their higher levels of tyrannical control. And yet, the message, if you look at pop literature, like Robert Anton Wilson's Illuminatus trilogy, sort of a front man for their whole milieu, and tries to put out a mythos that this is some sort of libertarian endeavor, it couldn't be anything further from the truth.
Also, when you talk about this left-right thing, and I'm just looking at it also in a political view, and that is when you say they ramp it up at certain points in time, it just reminded me, as you were saying that, about I don't think I've seen partisan politics as entrenched and as nasty as it's been in the last number of years.
That's right.
So much so that you can't get these people to understand that, you know, it's just a stage show to keep their eyes off what's really going on.
It's well said. Yes, indeed. And it serves a distracting purpose, and it serves a processing purpose in terms of alchemical group mind processing. And it serves a destabilizing and imbalancing purpose. And ultimately what it does is, while they're ping-ponging people back and forth, it's almost like if you take a piece of metal and you heat it and then you cool it rapidly and you heat it again and you keep alternating it between extremes in temperature, eventually the metal is weakened so you can just break it.
Right.
And by moving the populace back and forth and dividing it up, divide and conquer or shifting perceptions, they cook the group mind in an alchemical beaker, just like a Renaissance alchemist like Paracelsus. Theophrastus von Bombastus, or one of those characters, and they're cooking the group mind like this to make it more fragile and more amenable to control.
Go ahead.
I'm just going to say that they've reached a very high degree of success with that. If you try to open the eyes of many people with these topics, it's very difficult. I was just listening to a very brilliant man a few days ago who was lecturing on the need to have people start from correct first principles in their philosophy and their approach to life, and gee, there's so many errors out there in modern thought, and if we could only get people to see the truth and so forth. And I was listening and agreeing with him in many respects, but I'm thinking, you can't just immediately re-educate somebody who's in a hypnotic coma. You first have to pull them out of it. And I'm hoping that my book at least shocks the trance to some extent and acts like a pair of smelling salts. If it does that, I'll be very, very happy.
Yeah, we all will be, because, as you said, and did you ever hear of a gentleman by the name of Edward Bernays?
Come across that maybe in the past, but I can't connect it right now.
Well, the thing is, I had read his books, one called Crystallizing Public Opinion, the other one called Propaganda, written in the early 20s.
Okay.
And here he was probably the first PR man. And he talked about, you know, maybe we'll have seven holes in the news, and every time we want to introduce one, we'll pop the other one out. And what happens is, and as you said, this bit about the cracking people when they're both heated and cooled, you know, you'll hear contradicting things going back and forth. And, of course, TV, which we all thought was going to be such a boon to our lives, actually is the great enslaver, especially since it's gone 24/7.
Right.
And people sit there and they just get inundated with data.
Absolutely.
And, yeah, and they just give up. They just give up and they don't hear anything anymore. It's almost like they fail to, you know, emote.
Well, you hit the nail on the head. In fact, what I call the television set is the televised eye of Set. If you look into the occult forerunners and the ideologies and trace the Kabbalah back through children of Israel who picked it up from Egypt and Babylon, you go way the heck back to its start, and you find the worship of the dog star Sirius. Michael Hoffman has plenty of material on this as well. I want to give him some credit for that. And this is, of course, Set. The two stars, the binary dog star Sirius, had A and B, Sirius A and B, the binary star. And they're referred to as Set on, which, of course, relates very phonemically to Satan. So the televised eye of Set. Right. Set is a key figure in the mythos of the Kabbalah and the OTO because they interweave it appropriately with Egyptian gods and goddesses. And, of course, it calls to mind those who know about the occult, the spin-off group from Anton LaVey, and that's the Temple of Set, which was done by Colonel Michael Aquino, who has very high-level government clearance and connections still to this day. And the Temple of Set, Aquino invoked the lineage of Crowley and claimed to have inherited Crowley's mantle. Well, some people would dispute that, but there's no doubt about it that he's in the mainstream of their ideology at a certain level. But the Eye of Set is a figure on the back of everybody's dollar bill. People don't know what that eye is. It's the Eye of Horus, the Eye of Set. Mm-hmm. You can use either term. But at a certain level in the OTO, that symbol is explained in terms of sex magic, which I probably won't go into too many details on it, but it has to do with a homoerotic variety of that, and I'll spare your readers and or spare the listeners the details of that.
Right.
But that's on the back of everybody's dollar bill for a reason. It was put there by a Freemason. And it also relates to the image that was on DARPA's website, or Defense, and was pulled soon after it appeared, but it was there for a while, and I printed some pictures from it, and it showed the same eye beaming down on the planet, sort of rays of control. And, of course, it was in the recent movie National Treasure. They had references into that symbol and showed it and flashed it on the group mind. It's all over the place. But it's also a symbol of what's going on in everybody's living room and bedroom, where they have, most houses, I think, now have TVs in just about every room. You know, they have the big screen one to worship at, and then they've got one in every room to make sure that all their kids are brainwashed as well. And it's just a great mind control mechanism to do what Kenneth Grant, a prominent British leader of the OTO, said they need to spread the energies of Satan across the planet. Well, they've been very successful in doing that, and the TV has been a key instrument in achieving that aim.
I think you'll get a kick out of this, but when we're talking about Bernays, he had been over in England at the Tavistock Institute. He came over here and
that's right, okay.
Yeah, and he influenced, well, and what turns out to be is that his protégés later in his life were William Paley, and I believe Cronkite as well, but Paley, of course, goes on to spearhead the first real, I guess, network of importance, first one out in front, and that's CBS, and of course, what's their symbol?
Yes.
No coincidence.
What's their symbol? Yeah. And, you know, these symbols are so obvious to somebody who's actually studying the symbology of the occult and the Masonic and so forth and the Kabbalistic, but people who don't know it, it still influences them at a subliminal level. The populace is processed by these symbols, even if they're consciously reacting negatively. If you said, hey, do you know that's an occult symbol? Like, oh, you got to be crazy. But at a subliminal level, that eye has its impact.
Sure it does. And, you know, we were talking about this with the Collins also, because they talk about semiotics.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing is, we live our life by symbols. Our alphabet is, you know, our symbols. And so when you have these other trappings, they are not innocuous whatsoever.
Not at all.
Another question about Crowley, if I would. How was he perceived, do you know, during his time? Was he considered a clown? Or, you know, was that like the persona he wanted people to believe in? But behind the scenes, he actually was a very dangerous individual.
You've got it. Exactly. He projected a persona of notoriety. And the newspaper in England, John Bull, at one point described him, dubbed him with a phrase which has become famous or infamous relating to Crowley. They called him the wickedest man in the world. And he loved that. That was exactly what he wanted. He wanted to be in and out of the courtrooms, in and out of public opinion. He wanted to be in the newspapers as this sort of buffoon, drug addict, womanizer, controversial figure. Whereas behind the scenes, he's working along lodge lines and lines of setting up his network of lodges and producing exactly what he did produce, which is a huge spread of the OTO, including getting it over here into the United States of America, which he's very effective at doing.
I have one more question, Ashton, and I'd like to get to some of these bullet points that you forwarded, because I think that's important, the time we have left, that we get a chance to, to touch upon that. But, you know, you've used the word a couple of times today, and that is alchemy or alchemical.
Yes.
And most educated people will think back to Merlin and such and go, that wasn't really real stuff, was it? What is your take on alchemy? Were they transmuting metals? Are we looking at a society now that has got a technological alchemy? How do you feel about that?
Oh, that's a great question. Alchemy only symbolically dealt with the average person's understanding, which was trying to discover the philosopher's stone, which is a substance capable of transmuting base metals into gold and creating the elixir of life. That's the sort of textbook understanding, if you look it up, what is alchemy. And, of course, that was brought again to the forefront of consciousness, even imprinted on the minds of children through Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone, which the original title was Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. There's just blatant alchemy throughout those movies. But what is alchemy? They're actually using symbols, just as Masonry does. Masonry, if you look at it, they'll say we're a system of morality. Well, it's actually the morality of anti-morality, if you will. But they say we're a system of morality or conveyed through symbols. And symbols are everything for these people. So the Hermetic science of alchemy, and it's named after Hermes, the mythological god, it had another meaning, and that was that what they were really cooking and what they're really looking to change was mass consciousness. So while they're using symbols and writing about it, it's all code language. It's used to convey something else in the occult that they weren't willing to openly discuss for various reasons. Now, interestingly, the OTO they have something called the elixir of life, which has to do with something you can read about in my book. May not be appropriate for the radio, but it has to do with sex magic and a mixture that they create and ingest and so forth, and they call that Amrita. But that's not the end of the story. If you go through the OTO, you'll find those references, and you'll be thinking that you're getting to something that's behind the symbols of alchemy. Well, that's yet again just one more stepping stone, where the real alchemy is the transformation of the masses through ritual processes and symbolical tests and revelations. The revelation of the method, the testing of the group mind, exactly that left-right Kabbalah game, which we discussed earlier, is the process of cooking the group mind in an alchemical beaker.
Moving on, and if there's something you want to table, by all means do so.
Sure.
I don't want to, you know, be remiss in asking you to speak to what you believe should be spoken about in these last few minutes.
Well, last few minutes, I'll just touch on one. A lot of people say, what's the relationship between your writing and Skull and Bones? Well, I may get more into Skull and Bones in another book or something, I'm not sure, but I do get into it in terms of looking at its origins, going not just back to Germany, which a lot of people make the mistake to terminate some of these groups in Germany, but you have to look at the crucial Kabbalistic conceptual roots of Skull and Bones. And I don't think there's any other book out there that does that. But I go into the Zohar, which is the primary book of the Kabbalah, and show that there's the key reference to the skull in which 90 million worlds are operating. Well, that's a symbol, because the skull they're talking about is the skull of Adam Kadmon. And that is what is actually worshipped in Judaism at its highest levels, and that is the androgynous, perfected Judaic male, sort of the Gnostic Judaic male. And so inside the skull are 90 million worlds, which means that the highest level, the elites of Judaism, have control over 90 million worlds, which is, of course, a symbol for our world. So this is a conceptual level that goes right back to the Kabbalah and Judaism, and I think has been missed by every researcher so far looking at Skull and Bones, as well as the fact that, and some have gotten into this, skulls and bones are all over Masonic Lodge symbolism. I mean, this is nothing new with this order. You can also look, like Michael Hoffman did, at the origin of Skull and Bones, exactly when the anti-Mason party was shutting down lodges in the United States. Suddenly Skull and Bones springs up, without the official name of a lodge, but it continues the work at a very elite level. So Skull and Bones, I do go into its conceptual roots and give the keys to that in my book, and I think some people might be interested in that as well.
All right, and that probably took place, what, around the 1830s? When Okay. And was it Elihu Root that began Skull and Bones? Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. You got me kind of intrigued. I think if you could speak a little bit to this, Kinsey and the OTO.
Okay. Yeah, we got that movie out here by Rupert Murdoch's Fox Studios. And Kinsey was completely connected with Aleister Crowley. First of all, Kinsey was a pedophile. I mean, he used hundreds and hundreds of children in pederastic research to come up with his conclusions. That's been documented. But that's not in the movie. But also not in the movie is the fact that Kinsey made a pilgrimage to Crowley's Abbey of Thelema in Cefalù, Sicily, and was so entranced and enraptured with Crowley's work, he actually tried to get a hold of Crowley's diaries, his so-called magical diaries, because he wanted to keep them as an important source document for his own research. So here you have Kinsey, the so-called liberator. And what's behind Kinsey? A fascination with the occult, a connection to the OTO and to Crowley himself, and a direct pilgrimage to Crowley's center of Kabbalistic depravity in Cefalù, Sicily, Italy.
And to think the impact that the Kinsey Report had back in the 60s.
Yes.
You know, and how maybe it even changed a lot of people's attitudes towards things like marriage and sex and whatnot.
And it's still invoked today in all of the ongoing left-wing side of the alchemical cooker.
That's true. Also, before we go any further, Craig, can you give us some ordering information? I want to get that in before we come to an end.
Thank you. Blood on the Altar, The Secret History of the World's Most Dangerous Secret Society. It's available on Amazon.com. It's also available from the publisher, Independent History and Research, that's Michael Hoffman II, at revisionisthistory.org, www.revisionisthistory.org. You can also find a CD of mine, The Double Mind, in occult philosophy, which some might find sort of high-level study of some of this stuff.
Well, Blood on the Altar is excellent in every way, shape, and form. And I've
thank
it.
You.
You're very welcome. It's been worth the wait to get you on, believe me.
Thank you.
Boy, you haven't given up one second here. So good for you. Another point that very intriguing, OTO and the space program.
OTO and the space program. In bed with each other from the beginning, and specifically through Jack Parsons, John Whiteside Parsons, who is the founder of Aerojet, co-founder of Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California. There's a lot on him in my book, and Parsons was the leader of the Agape Lodge, which is ironically or sarcastically named that, in Pasadena, California. His connections go to the Hollywood elites as well as the space program through that lodge. And he recited a ritual invocation to Pan, the hoofed god, before the launching of test rockets and so forth. He was a key figure and called himself the Antichrist, by the way. These guys love to give themselves titles like that.
Right.
He was involved in ritual productions of a homunculus, which is another Kabbalistic project. I think probably time is limited, and you can read about it in my book. But if you want to read about what's happened to our space program, where's it come from, and what's the point of it, there's some keys to that in my book.
Or, if you don't mind, I want to ask you a question because of what I'm getting involved with, and I'd like to hear your take on it.
Sure.
All right. A number of the people that are interviewees lately were dealing with these semiotics, the symbolism that we see, especially as it relates to 9/11.
Right.
However, we had a guest on a long time ago who said, it's Dr. Rebecca Carley. She said, if you want to see where the future's going in terms of the occult, she said, just watch Hollywood and the Sci-Fi Channel. She said, because in their sick Masonic minds, if they tell you they're going to do something to you, then it's okay to do it. How do you feel about that?
Well, I would explain it a little bit differently, but I see your point very well, and I would look at it in terms of the rubric of the revelation of the method, and the way I explain that is in terms of hypnosis. In other words, if you're taking somebody down in a trance, if you're a hypnotist, you start with a light trance and so forth through suggestion, you get them under, and you want to deepen the trance, you give them a test, you tell them something that could wake them up, but you take a little bit of a risk there. And if they don't wake up, they actually go deeper at that point. And at the same time, a secondary result of that is you now have a gauge to know that they're at least past that level of trance depth. So when the cryptocracy, of which the OTO is the master right, the secret rulers, if they tell you they're going to do something to you, they're also testing your trance. And if you don't come out of it as a populace, like they came out of it in the 18... late 1820s, 1830s with the Anti-Mason Party, which was very successful in the United States for a while. If we don't do something like that and organize, we go deeper. And that's part of the function of the revelation of the method.
So do you see popular movies and TV shows as being conduits of this kind of symbolism?
Absolutely. I make a few references to that in my book, and specifically in terms of some of the stuff done to children. But absolutely, that's one of its primary functions.
Have you, by any chance, seen that movie, National Treasure?
No, I'm extremely busy, and I do intend to see it soon. I'm just going off of looking at its trailer and checking out some other sources on it. But I plan to get to it at some point soon.
And not to become preoccupied with 9/11, but there's one individual working on going back and looking at a lot of films to see if there's anything there. And, you know, whether maybe it's coincidence, fine, but there's a lot there.
There's a lot there.
To be explained. And, you know, also, how long had they had this in their minds? If Daddy Bush conjures New World Order for the first time in the United States on 9/11, I think it was 1990, and it happened again and again on 9/11. I mean, I look at this as this kind of sick joke that's being played out amongst all them, and of course the joke is on us.
Right.
And so I believe, well, and you would agree too, wouldn't you, that numerology is also very big to these people?
Oh, it's enormous. And it's enormous not only to these people, not only to occult orders, not only to Freemasons, but it's right back to the Kabbalah itself.
And all these religions, though, don't you find, and I know that I went to the website, or cult societies, rather. I went to the OTO website, and every one of these, no matter Kabbalah, whatever, do you find that it always goes for that play on Lucifer and that leitmotif?
Yes. Yeah, they love to come back to that. He's the philosopher's light bearer. That's what Lucifer basically meant in the Latin. And, of course, the meaning of that was, I'll go into that to some extent in the book, but the meaning of that had to do in the Old Testament with an identification of tyrannical kings and the power that energizes them, which is, of course, Lucifer. So both are referenced in Scripture, and there's a close connection between the two. And because the occult is seeking to impose this new order of the ages that you're talking about, well, has basically been very successful with it to this extent. We're getting to some key moments coming up where it's going to be winner take all, probably. But because they love to impose this, they're constantly also invoking the energy behind it, which is Lucifer.
There also seems to be another commonality, and that is all of these societies and religions try to elevate the self.
Yes.
As that you can be a god.
That's right. In fact, they explicitly say that the motto of the OTO is Deus est homo, God is man. That's their motto. And that, of course, is Genesis 3:5, when the serpent says, ye shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. So it all goes back right to the Garden of Eden.
And, again, we're not going to have time to get into another individual upon whom you write much, and that's James Wasserman.
Yes.
But what I did want to ask you was, it seems strange to me that every so often, maybe when the war effort gets a little low or whatever, it seems Bush and whoever come out and they speak in terms of crusades.
Right.
They use the Muslim as a whipping boy whenever it suits them and makes this thing another, like, holy crusade.
Right. It's an anti-crusade, really, but they disguise it as a crusade, and they invoke this sort of imagery of the Christian versus the Muslim. Well, that imagery was on OTO leader James Wasserman's book, which came out just a few months before 9/11, called The Templars and the Assassins. And on the cover of that book, he has an image of Knights Templars, only their colors are reversed, showing that this is sort of a false crusade he's symbolizing here. And he has them coming over a wall with two towers. Well, what happened on 9/11? And facing him on the other side of the wall is two shadowy Islamic terrorists, which could be taken to stand for, I suppose, Usama. Right. The name's been spelled both ways. So right just a few months before 9/11, this book comes out, and then you have this 9/11 event, you have this supposed new crusade, but it's really not fought by Christians. It's fought by Judeo-Churchians or Judeo-Christians who are anti-Christians, like Bush, members of Skull and Bones and so forth. And they're fighting, they're not really fighting to defeat Islam.
No.
They're fighting to instill and in further Judaic hegemony,
Craig,
and Zionism. That's what it's all about.
That is true. And on that, we're going to have to leave it. Craig Hink, thank you so much for coming on at long last, and you did a great job, and I thank you for being at the Grassy Knoll.
You're more than welcome. It's a true pleasure.
And I'm going to send some stuff along through emails and images that you might be interested in.